The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, today you're in Europe, and you know there's been an awful lot of Europe in the news this week between Ireland and the protests in Germany and, of course, just the things that are going on with the World Bank and the G20. Tell us about it.
Well, Kevin, it's always interesting to be on the continent, and I think that between Paris, Florence, Rome, you know, Zurich, we have quite a bit of business here in Europe, and it is interesting to be here, very interesting to be here, when in fact you've got people marching on the streets in Germany in protest of an Irish bailout. And of course, in recent weeks and months here in Paris, as well as in Brussels, there's been mass protests, which, if you recall, the last time I was here, the IMF was adamant that 2010 would be a year full of civil unrest, and they thought that the scene in Europe was set to be explosive. And in fact, we've seen it in months. Whether it is people adjusting to a different level of civil services and retirement expectations, or in the case of Germany, which we have even today, the idea that the Germans simply don't want to pick up the bill. The Germans are feeling very German today. And that's, I guess, to be expected in the context of crisis. That's when you begin to see people think in terms of their own nationalities, their own states, even their own towns and families. Things get very micro in the context of a financial crisis.
Well, David, in the news right now has been the G20 meeting and actually the ineffectiveness of it, and actually also the uncooperative spirit in G20. You've got everybody talking about their own agenda right now, and actually the angers have been rising. Have you heard anything while you're there about G20?
Kevin, a part of it has to do with just how obtuse it comes across for the U.S. contingent to be there and be proclaiming how things should operate in the world of monetary and financial matters, when, you know, this really is like the man who's put his car in the ditch telling you how to avoid putting your car in the ditch. You'd really like it from a more credible source. You'd like it from someone who's getting the job done as opposed to really mucking things up. So I guess from the G20, you know, we have a very interesting story. Asia has basically pushed back and said, no, it's really not our problem to revalue our currency. It's your problem to quit destroying the world monetary system. It's not our choice that this is a dollar-centric monetary regime. And in fact, if we get a vote, perhaps we'll change that in the future. So, Kevin, I think of Obama's requests made at the G20. It reminds me of conversations I have with my four-year-old. There are things that he is so convinced are good for him, and with great fervent sincerity, you know, he puts his case in front of me. And I kind of have to smile, and I reflect that he just doesn't have a clue.
Isn't that what the Chinese were doing, David? I mean, the Chinese were basically saying, what are you talking about? If you eliminate the trade surplus, I mean, you said this on your comments last Friday. If you eliminate the trade surplus that China has right now, you said you cut your nose off to spite your face, because that's actually who's buying our debt right now with that surplus.
Well, essentially, Kevin, we've got multiple lines of credit out to us. We spend more than we bring in terms of our national income, and we have to finance the difference. And so financing it requires the kindness of strangers, as it were, and the Chinese are a major source of that funding. And curiously, Kevin, it is the trade surplus that they have with us, because we spend too much, that they end up recycling into our treasury markets, essentially funding our deficit. So how is it that making this trade imbalance pay and raising the value of the yuan, as it were, how is that going to help us? In fact, it's going to hurt us. And again, that brings me back to my son. He has an excuse when he's asking for something that really isn't for him. He doesn't know it. He's 4 years old. You should expect more of a team of PhDs from Harvard and MIT and the crowd that has surrounded our current president.
So, David, aren't they operating on a huge false assumption right now based on the dollar?
It's the Treasury, it's the Fed, Obama team. I'm not pointing individual fingers. It's the whole collective, and they're racing at their peril and ours into a misguided and very destabilizing policy measures, a whole set of policy measures. So yeah, I think the assumption that underlies our activity, Kevin, is that the dollar as the king currency can never be dethroned. And what they're forgetting is the truism, the king is dead. long live the king. And that's, I think, something that continental Europe is much more familiar with, both in terms of the political dethroning and rethroning, but also in terms of the currency revolutions or revulsions that happen with some frequency. Not just a currency, but an entire currency regime can be thrown out.
Well, David, one of the things that makes things so uncertain right now is this whole floating currency thing. I mean, would you explain to the listener the difference between a fixed rate currency and a currency that's floating based on buying and selling demand?
Well, Kevin, I think one of the things that the Fed testing, along with Obama and the Treasury, is that we have the Chinese currency fixed to, at a set rate, fixed to the U.S. dollar.
Right.
And that's somewhat similar to the nature of all currencies during an earlier period, the gold standard era. And we've departed from today, you know, post-1971, we have a free system. That's the exact opposite of a fixed system. And Kevin, I think if the Fed is to continue what has been a very low probability event, the idea of re-monetization of gold or the reintroduction of gold into our monetary system as a partial backing, I think, Kevin, that gets put back on the table. And we'll discuss, should the Fed, in their own opinions, embarrassingly be forced to take on an anchor that has previously governed sound money, and of course, the healthy global trade that we saw in the last period of globalization, sort of 1860 to 1914. But that system has long been resisted, and it's long been derided as something that is really only for those who are worried about the end of the world, sort of the nervous Nellies amongst the hoi polloi. The greater education you have, the PhDs in economics and finance have for at least 20 or 30 years, so actually just a very short period of time, neglected their economic history and have considered gold a worthless and anachronism, not something that can be a part of the money system. But I think that's what we're moving towards.
Well, David, here in America, in our media, is CNBC, Wall Street Journal, what have you, we don't hear much about rebacking a currency with gold. But hasn't there been some rumbling in the other parts of the world? I mean, like even in the Financial Times, that salmon-colored financial paper that most Americans don't pay any attention to, but the rest of the world treats as the major economic news of the day. Now, haven't they been talking about something in this vein?
You're right. Just a week ago, the president of the World Bank, Robert Zoellick, in an op-ed piece run on the front page of the Financial Times, reflected that, and I quote, although textbooks may view gold as old money, markets are using gold as an alternative monetary asset today, end quote, which I think, Kevin, is worthy of mention for several reasons. First of all, the financial and banking establishment realize that there are systemic problems which are only being exacerbated by the monetary policies of the U.S. Central Bank. And it's from that crowd, our central bank, which we've heard very arrogantly say, it's our money and it's your problem. Many of our officials, both political in the area of monetary policy, have repeatedly said, it's our money and your problem. So, Kevin, I think more scary is that the majority in that community really only remember the textbook reflections that Mr. Zoellick is making mention of. The idea that gold is old money, the idea that gold is an anachronism, that gold has no place in a modern, and somehow we pack a lot of significance and meaning into that word modern system.
Well, David, let's face it. This is what Zoellick was talking about. Markets are going to use gold whether the currencies are backed by gold or not. That's the direction that they're going, as an alternative currency. Isn't that the case?
Yeah, Kevin, I think the second point to make there is that if there is not an institutional revolution in thought within the central banking community wherein stability rules reflective, at least reflective of the gold standard or including a modified gold standard are reintroduced, then guess what? Individuals will continue to create their own gold backing for cash deposits in an effort to protect their personal wealth. That activity, Kevin, taken on a broad, will create a self-reinforcing destruction of the current currency regime. And I think, Kevin, with it, will deliver a blow to the credibility of central bankers across the globe, which I don't know that they'll recover from for a generation.
So, David, what would your advice to Ben Bernanke be?
My advice to Ben would be get as proactive as possible on this one. And if you don't, be willing to face the wrath of the marketplace, discounting both your ineptitude and your bankrupt economic model. It's pretty bad when consumer protections have to be implemented by citizens in order to avoid a Ponzi-like activity thrust on them, both by Congress and the Fed. I don't think that the new financial reform bill addressed the destruction of savers and those on fixed incomes as a result of our out-of-control money printing, specifically by the Fed. But it's ironic that we have things like the reform bill coming through, and maybe it's a response to the Bernie Madoffs of the world, but we've got a whole group of Bernie Madoffs that are literally ripping off the fixed income class as we speak. And so again, Kevin, I think my advice to Ben is you better get out in front of this one or you're going to face the wrath of the marketplace.
Well, you know, the thing that they're facing right now is this lost credibility, not just within the nation, but around the world. I mean, the rest of the world is now treating us as if they're making the rules or they're going to at least reevaluate the rules we've made.
It's interesting, Kevin, every time you look at a currency revolution, if you will, in the last 150 years, what you're really talking about is the destruction of credibility. When you destroy credibility, you lose the privilege of having a respected opinion in the marketplace, and you even lose the ability to operate as you prefer or as you would design. And this is a problem. When you lose credibility, you end up being the subject of someone else's rule. Mm-hmm. And so I think when you think of the G20 and what's been happening in the last week or two leading up to it and then all the way through it, the international community is mulling over what rules should now apply to us as opposed to the rules that we've set for ourselves.
David, let's specifically now talk about the dollar. That's the backbone of the reserve currency system worldwide. That's been that way since the end of World War II. But things are changing right now. So give us some reflections as they pertain to the dollar right now, especially from this European perspective while you're over there.
Well, I'm reminded of the comments from Greg Weldon just a week or so ago. You know, we discussed being near a monetary black hole, you know, a place where the gravitational pull is so total that even, as you've described to me, Kevin, even a photon lacking mass cannot escape once it has passed its event horizon. We've got the dollar being sucked inescapably into darkness, Kevin. I think, unfortunately, the die is cast for the dollar because there's very little political will to tougher course in relation to our fiscal and monetary world. So I've looked back a little bit, Kevin, as I've been thinking about the dollar in preparation for coming to Paris and to Brussels. I've been thinking and reading on some of the changes we've seen since the end of the gold standard era, 1914. And of course, that was the year after the creation of the Fed. And it was right at the beginning of World War I. I read some interesting things. Love being on the plane, Kevin. It gives me 6, 7, 8, 10 hours to do nothing but read, and I really enjoy it. I read an article by Barry Eichengreen and Michael Bordeaux. Michael's been on the program before. This is from a book called Monetary History, Exchange Rates, and Financial Markets. And there was a significant change, Kevin, in the frequency of both banking crises and also currency crises following the gold standard period, that 1880 to 1914 period. Of course, there was both banking and currency crises during the gold standard, but they put some numbers together that I thought were very, very interesting.
So, David, we live in a day and age where banking crisis and currency crisis are pretty much synonymous. We see these things accompany each other and are blamed for each other. Are you saying there was a distinction in the past when we were under the gold standard?
Kevin, there was a much clearer distinction between banking crises on the one hand, which were more isolated events, and then currency crises, which were also separate in time frame and at a different cause. Yet, when gold was no longer a part of the money system, banking crises were always followed by currency crises. So that period, all of a sudden, they're synonymous. They do happen back to back. That connection alone should give us a reason to pause and reflect on the legitimacy or illegitimacy of the current fiat money system.
Once again, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. If you do have questions that you'd like us to answer over the next several weeks, please email us at McIlvaney@McIlvaney.com. So that's McIlvaney@McIlvaney.com. Well, David, you know, looking back, I mean, there are differences between countries that we would consider banana republics or emerging markets, let's call them that, or industrial countries. Do you see a difference when looking back at history as to the relationship between banking crisis, currency crisis, and the type of country that it is?
Just as intriguing as sort of the combination, now you've got a duo of crises, just as intriguing as that new duo complex was that there was a 10 to 15-fold increase in currency crisis in both emerging markets and industrial countries if you're comparing two particular time frames. And they did a great job of laying this out. If you look at the 1880 to 1913 period and contrast that with something more contemporary, solidly in the fiat money system, 1973 to 1997, that period, what you have is, again, this is emerging markets. You went from 6 currency crises in the first period, in that new era, 57. And then in industrial countries, you went from two currency crises during the period of 1880 to 1913 to 29. And this is industrial countries, Kevin. This is not full-fledged, robust economies still in that period, 1973 to 1997, in the context of a fiat money system as opposed to a gold standard. You went from 2 to 29 separate currency crises.
So, David, let me just restate that and understand what you're saying. I mean, when we were under a gold standard, we're talking about 6 currency crises during the gold standard in emerging markets and 2 currency crises under the gold standard in the industrialized nations. So, let's face it, virtually non-existent when you compare it to 57 currency crises in emerging markets and 29 currency crisis in the industrialized nations after the gold standard went away. So it's almost a guarantee, a tenfold guarantee, that you're going to have crisis when you're under a fiat non-backed currency. Isn't that right?
Kevin, the amazing thing is how out of control the money masters are. And this is where there's a tremendous amount of pretense. They do pretend that the gold standard in its sort of prehistoric and obtuse state is people who just really don't understand higher math and things of that nature. But listen, Kevin, the current experts would like us to believe that they've created a better system, they've a more stable system. And I just ask the question, you be the judge, is this working?
Well, and let me ask you a question, David. Were the currency crises pre-1914 as severe as the ones that we face today?
Well, they were considered less severe because of what was called the Restoration Rule. And the Restoration Rule was this assumption that the currency, even if it had to break away from the gold standard temporarily, just like the British pound in the Napoleonic Wars, that it would return to parity with the gold standard and reestablish its stability as soon as possible, that the gold peg would be realigned. And in fact, that is what happened. Sometimes it took 5 years, sometimes it took 9 years. I mean, it did take some time after a major currency crisis because the government basically blow out the monetary doors and print money like there was no tomorrow. But they did it selectively and for only short periods of time. It reminds me, Kevin, I guess where we sit today, and I always think of Jacques Rouffe when I'm in Paris, but he wrote the book, The Monetary Sin of the West, and I've mentioned this before, but it was originally published in Le Monde. It was the London Times and Fortune magazine in 61, but originally in Le Monde. And he talked about what we were about to see in the inflationary 70s. You'd call Jacques Rouffe was the financial attaché to Charles de Gaulle. And flying into the de Gaulle airport, again, it just kind of rekindles all these things when I'm in Paris.
Well, David, yeah, that's a fascinating book. And you always become reminiscent of Jacques Rouffe when you're over in Europe. He was a brilliant man, and he really did see what was coming as far as the destruction of the dollar. And, you know, with de Gaulle being able to change dollars for gold, Jacques Rouffe is the one who actually told him to get that done before Nixon closed the gold window. Now, I might mention too, David, that our listeners can read that book if they go online to Mises.org. I believe that they can have a free download of that book and actually read it, if that's of interest.
Kevin, it has to be of interest because, I mean, it really gets into the ideas, the warnings that Rouffe was offering to de Gaulle, you know, that they needed, the French needed to settle their accounts with the American government in gold instead of paper script. And this is what was a part of the money system at the time. This is the pre-1971 era, money era. There was an implicit guarantee coming from Bretton Woods, and this had been done regularly up until 1968, when a massive rush on the gold in Fort Knox forced a revision of the parameters of that gold exchange, namely that the U.S. monetary authorities could limit access to settlement of those transactions, limit that access to bullion. And in fact, that's what we saw Nixon do, close the gold window in 1971. It's also worth mentioning, Kevin, that it was just a few years later, 1977, when the Federal Reserve completely changed their mandate. The very boring job of the Fed was to create money and be willing to exchange coinage for dollars. That was the role of the central bank. And then all of a sudden in 1977, they redefine and give themselves a dual mandate, which is basically inflation control and employment. Now they have to be concerned. The scary thing about this, Kevin, is that without thinking about it, we brought central banks into our country and made them central planners. We brought central banks into our country and elevated them to the place of central planners. They define what our political structure looks like today. With the free-flowing cash from the Federal Reserve, we have created an utterly corrupt system where our Congress has access to limitless amounts of money. And the idea of earmarks, the idea of pork barrel spending, all of these things go away with limited access to capital. But when it is limitless, that is when corruption becomes rife.
Well, David, that reminds me, okay, the free market doesn't necessarily always play ball with this central banking community. I'm thinking of the Tuesday, November 16th, yesterday's Wall Street Journal headline that says the bond market defies the Fed. I mean, bond prices have been falling the last couple of weeks. Interest rates have been rising, even in the face of the Federal Reserve coming in and saying that they were going to monetize and keep rates low. What's the impact of that?
Kevin, your bond traders and your hedge fund community are looking very critically at the market response internationally. And this brings us back to the G20, this very adamant response to $100 monetization, $900 billion if you include what's being rolled over from the mortgage-backed securities. And Kevin, basically they're sending a very clear message. We don't like it. Don't do this again. In fact, you might consider changing course. And so the bond market, which had assumed up until the last week or so that they were going to get support from the Fed, is now discounting the fact that it's going to be a very weak amount of support. We've already seen their activity in the marketplace, Kevin, buying 5- and 6-year treasuries instead of the previously stated long-term bonds. And so again, the long-term bond has sold off. Critical support, Kevin, was at 129. If you're looking at the price of the long bond, we were up 136, 137. Long-term support at 129. It broke that support, fell precipitously to 125 just here in the last few days. And we have the bond market. It's not the vigilantes. It's our overseas creditors saying, we don't buy it. We don't think that actually you're going to make good on your debt payments. And we think that that default is going to be a very subtle form, aka inflation. So, Kevin, when we come back to Jacques Roof, when we come back to Paris, when we come back to the revolution and the monetary regime that happened in 71, and we begin to ask the question, are we on the cusp of another monetary revolution? I'd say we're closer and closer by the day.
Well, you know, David, not only does it create problems in the bond market when we start seeing these artificial buying of treasury bills that are keeping interest rates unnaturally low, but of course it turns into inflation. I mean, a lot of people this week are going and buying their turkey for next week. And just over the last week, turkey prices have risen, let's face it, $1.09 a pound for turkey prices in the last week, that increase. We're seeing inflation all across the board. Isn't this what really is making these other countries mad? This rapid currency devaluation, this currency trade war that we've entered into.
Kevin, I don't want this to sound very critical, but we live in an amazing country. I'm proud to be an American. I love living there. Would never want to live anywhere else. And I'm reminded of just how provincial our mindset can become living in such a massive country. And so many things that we can and do take for granted. It is worth listening to the voice of our foreign creditors and seeing what exactly it is they're upset about. Jacques Roof gave counsel to de Gaulle all throughout the 60s and said, listen, account balances are totally inappropriate and out of whack. I saw it when I was in Great Britain in the 30s. We're going to see a default. We're going to see our primary debtor, the United States, default on its own, at least through inflation. Take the gold. That was the voice of our foreign creditor. We've got the voice of our foreign creditor today echoing from the 1960s and 70s, that same resounding theme, which is inflation, my friend, you're going to hurt your credibility. Inflation, my friend, we're not going to extend you more loans if you're going to default on what is already outstanding. Kevin, we've got to listen.
Well, David, we're not the only ones seeing this. The rest of the world's not the only one seeing this. You were with James Grant 3 weeks ago, and he and a number of other top names in the financial world have written an open letter to Ben Bernanke saying that they disagree with this new quantitative easing. It's fascinating, too. The Federal Reserve sent a response.
Kevin, it's not very often that the Fed takes the time to address specific criticisms, but from the likes of someone like James Grant, understandable. He is a very, very respected person on Wall Street, and particularly when it comes to the bond market. Kevin, I think one of the things that he's pointing to is that the gold standard does need to be revisited, that there has to be some sort of anchor and credibility that is added back to the dollar as our credibility is in fact eroding. If you want to read that article, I'd encourage you to look it up online. Look for the New York Times article. You can just Google New York Times Jim Grant. Read the article and consider his arguments. It's very well stated. It's very reasonably stated. And again, it was compelling enough for the Fed to respond. So perhaps you can tell the listeners what the response of the Fed was.
Sure. And I'm just quoting the Federal Reserve responding back to this group of men who wrote this open letter. It says, and I quote, "As the chairman has said, the Federal Reserve has congressionally mandated objectives to help promote both increased employment and price stability. In light of persistently weak job creation and declining inflation, the Federal Open Market Committee's recent actions reflect both of these mandates." Now, David, you've pointed out in the past the danger of the Fed mandate pursuing full employment. It seems to always lead to inflation.
Kevin, that was probably the most critical point made in the conversation with Giulio Galrodi just a few months ago, and that's certainly a program that our listeners should go back and listen to, that with universal suffrage has come the politicization of the budget and the impossible task of keeping inflation away. If you have an entirely fiat system, Kevin, and the angry masses, or 51% tyranny, as de Tocqueville called it, or democracy, as others have called it, then what you have is an out-of-control spending habit, and you have inflation baked, and there's no way around an inflationary outcome. So that, again, Kevin, is why if we don't see, and I think we may be on the cusp of a monetary revolution, if we don't see it happen institutionally, individuals will protect themselves and guard themselves again. They have been doing that for 10 years now, and they will continue to as we head into the height of this inflationary era.
Well, David, I know that these European and Asian trips are always enlightening for you. I know that next week you're going to be in Brussels, Belgium, and you'll be talking to Ambrose Evans-Pritchard specifically about the European situation.
Kevin, I'm looking forward to the conversation with Ambrose. He should bring some insight into the present state of affairs, both in Ireland, as well as in Germany, Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain. There's more and more things that are rumbling in terms of a round two. Certainly we're seeing that in the bond market here in Europe, where credit default spreads are on the rise again, and the risk of default is rising very rapidly in Ireland. It could be imminent even within days.
Well, and that will be next week's show, and I'm looking forward, David, to actually getting to the questions that you've encouraged the listeners to send to McIlvaney@McIlvaney.com. You know, this last week, that was the first time that we had mentioned that our listeners should send in questions for the following show, and boy, we got questions from all over the world, didn't we?
Kevin, we have questions from Hong Kong, questions from Italy, questions from the Netherlands, questions from Kansas and Iowa and Florida, New York and Washington, all over.
All over. Well, David, thank you for taking time away from Paris long enough to talk to us this week. And we do want to remind our listeners to go ahead and send those questions in, don't we?
Absolutely. Kevin, just want to end with one last anecdote. This afternoon, I went to the Drew Auction House, and it's here in downtown Paris. 60,000 people shuffle through every day to look at estates that are being settled through this auction house. Kevin, it's similar to Christie's and Sotheby's. We looked at furniture today that was anywhere from 50,000 euros for a small bureau to 250,000 or 500,000 for even a small grandfather clock. That's euros. And the fascinating thing, Kevin, is everything comes in and goes out day after day after day. You're watching the wealthy of Europe file into a place like that. They'd rather have furniture sitting in their living room. They'd rather have these beautiful pieces of art hanging on their walls rather than banks holding on to their capital and watching it as a result of poor fiscal management and monetary management. So, Kevin, it's interesting, again, I think back to our previous conversations from Paris, very little recession amongst the upper class. I think what's different is you're beginning to see much more and more traffic into tangibles as they try to protect themselves from an inevitable currency demise.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney in Paris, and we would like to encourage our listeners to go ahead and send questions in that they would like answered over the next few weeks to McIlvaney@McIlvaney.com. Thanks for listening.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.